I also want to address the Tonys.
On a recent episode of Checking In with Michelle Williams, I open up about feeling snubbed by the Tony Awards. Do I?
I was never mad. I was disappointed because I had high hopes.
To hear this and more on disappointment and protecting your peace, listen to Checking In with Michelle Williams from the Black Effect Podcast Network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up, y'all? This your main man, Memphis Bleek, right here, host the Rock Solid Podcast. June is Black Music Month, so what better way to celebrate than listening to my exclusive conversation with my bro, Ja Rule?
The one thing they can't stop you or take away from you is knowledge. So whatever I went through while I was down in prison for 2 years, through that process, learn from it.
Check out this exclusive episode with Ja Rule on Rock Solid. Open your free iHeartRadio app, search Rock Solid, and listen now.
You say you'd never give in to a meltdown. Never let kids' toys take over the house. And never fill your feed with kid photos. You'd never plan your life around their schedule. Never lick your thumb to clean their face. And you'd never let them leave the house looking like less than their best. You say you'd never put a pacifier in your mouth to clean it. Never let them stay up too late. And never let them run wild through the grocery store.
Clean up on aisle 6 and aisle 3.
So when you say you'd never let them get into a car without you there, know it can happen. 1 in 4 hot car deaths happen when a kid gets into an unlocked car and can't get out. Never happens. Before you leave the car, always stop. Look. Lock. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
On the morning of August 20th, 2012, a Detroit house fire killed 2 men, Bobby Cross and Daryl Sims. Citing an argument from the night prior, the Cross family wondered whether Bobby Cross's girlfriend's son, Dwayne Williams, had set the blaze. However, with no evidence of arson, these deaths were ruled accidental until 3 months later, when someone tied to the family was looking for a way out of a jam. They claimed that Dwayne confessed to this arson, sending him away for life. This is wrongful conviction.
You're listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. I'm Ben Bullen, the host of Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, and your host here on Wrongful Conviction for the next few episodes. This story takes us to Detroit, Michigan, where we've previously covered stories involving an elaborate jailhouse snitch system. We'll link some of those in the episode description, but this one is a little different from those scenarios. And the state's alleged witness in this case was able to flip 2 accidental deaths into a double homicide charge for our guest today, Dwayne Williams. Dwayne, thanks for joining us, man.
Thank you for having me.
We also want to welcome the co-director of the Cooley Innocence Project, Ann Garrett. Thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
As well as Maya Menlo from the Michigan Appellate Defender's Office.
Thanks.
What I think we should start off with first is to have you tell us a little bit about your childhood before the series of tragic events.
I'm from a neighborhood in Detroit called Brightmoor. It's on the west side of Detroit. If you ask them about it, it has a reputation for like selling drugs and like the neighborhood being abandoned. I would say it's considered possibly one of the worst neighborhoods on the west side. That's the neighborhood I grew up in. Mm-hmm. I hate that I had to grow up somewhere like that, but it helped to make me the person who I was. Now, in my childhood, I lived with my mother till I was about 7. From 7 to 13, I ended up having to go live with my grandmother because of physical abuse. But I think that maybe separation issues or the situation with my mother, my father not being there, I started getting into trouble, hanging with the wrong people. Luckily, I always had like an interest in music, though.
What's the kind of music that speaks to you?
Rap, hip-hop. I think like when I was younger, when I would have problems, I would just listen to the music. That's all I did. And around that time, I figured out that I could rap. I used to write poetry before that. And I just kind of put the poetry to music. Unfortunately, when I was like 14, I got locked up for stealing cars. And I went to a place called Boysville in Michigan.
Dwayne spent nearly 4 years there. But when he was released, he continued to follow his music dreams through the early 90s.
I always was doing something with music, but music didn't make money. So I kind of was off and on with it. I was managed by a company called Starlight Entertainment and Limousine. They had limousines. So what we would do is, if you were a promoter and you were bringing somebody big in, then we would basically tell you, we'll give you the limousine to pick this guy up at the airport, take him to the shows, take him to the hotel, any promotional events that you have. But you have to put, my stage name was Diablo. So you have to put Diablo on the show. My name has to be on all the flyers, all the radio advertisements. And when you go to pick that artist up, I'm in the limo. You can believe that.
That's a pretty brilliant move.
That gave me the ability to connect with the artist or anybody else who was with him. Besides getting rich, I did everything in the music business. I signed autographs, I toured, and like how Eminem says, you only have one shot to blow. I actually have had probably a shot at 4 major record deals. But at any rate, the point that I want to make was I had way more opportunities than most people to be successful in the music business. But because of my past and another wrongful conviction, it basically messed all of that up.
And this isn't the first time we've had a guest with multiple wrongful convictions. Dwayne was on the receiving end of a false accusation, but with no evidence. He was still convicted of a lesser charge in 2002, after which his public defender responded to his claims of innocence with, and this is a quote, "Well, innocent people go to jail too," end quote. Dwayne paroled in 2004, and the address on record belonged to his mom's longtime boyfriend, Bobby Cross.
Bobby Cross was like a bully. He was kind of a big guy, and anybody who knows him, they know this is true. He basically bullied everybody around him. One day I was at a neighbor's house, and he started telling me, basically, get your shit, excuse my language, get your shit in that bitch shit out of my house. And he was talking about my mother. And the neighbors now, they want us out of the house. So when they're sending us out of the house, I'm basically telling Bobby, hey, look, I don't want no problems with you. I don't want no trouble. Whatever you talk. And every time I try to walk away from him, he would, like, step in front of me and block me. So I told him I ain't want no physical altercation. He told me that's what he wanted. So to make a long story short, I hit him and I knocked him out. And so it hurts his pride. So for years and years, he never brought it up. We never had problems about it. But because I know the type of person he is, and this is really embarrassing to him, from that point on, if he was drinking and had a gun, I sit there for 4 or 5 minutes and I'm leaving.
So it appears, as is honestly often the case, that alcohol can exacerbate personality traits as well as a quietly held grudge. And so Dwayne chose never to live at that address while continuing to pursue his music dreams with this brilliant limousine strategy.
Eventually, we did that a few times with T-Pain. And when T-Pain's brother saw that, he basically told me, hey, it's amazing. In the midst of this, I started sending my music all over the country and clubs started booking me. So now I'm basically nobody. But, well, yeah, he's nobody, but he's connected to T-Pain. T-Pain's brother manages him. So now they're paying me to come to different places in America to do shows.
Wow.
But unfortunately, I had a bad parole officer who didn't like me. MDOC gave me permission to do so, and he would have to approve them, and he would never approve them. So because this took away my source of income, when me and my wife are married now, I'm basically like looking for regular jobs, and I'm just trying to make it.
And that brings us to August 2012. This is when Dwayne and his new wife spend the weekend of the 18th and 19th with Dwayne's mother and with Bobby Cross. They're following leads on a new place to live in that area. And when Sunday came, there was a barbecue in the neighborhood, as well as some drinking that went late into the night.
I had got some steaks for somebody to barbecue. At some point, somebody told me that Bob Cross wanted to talk to me. So I went across the street. He told me that I cooked steaks and I didn't offer him one. I told him that you can have all of them. He told me that he didn't like steaks. So basically, it's nothing else to say.
It appears this was just the beginning of some unnecessary drama. So the night continued on, as did the drinking, all the way until somewhere after 2 a.m.
In the midst of this, an argument occurs between my wife, Bobby Cross's daughter, and Bobby Cross. This disagreement, and I'm not even in it, but it got turned around to look like something else. So from 2 in the morning to whatever time in the morning when my mother left, my mother and Bobby Cross, basically, they're arguing from room to room. The last thing my mother said to me was, "I'm leaving before he kills everybody in the house." And they drinking. I ain't paying no attention to that. I went to the bathroom. When I came out of the bathroom, I saw Bobby Cross standing there with a shotgun. He never said anything to me, never threatened me. Nothing happened. But now he has a gun. So I left. And now it's 4 in the morning.
So Dwayne left to find somewhere else to stay for the night. Bobby was sleeping it off. Around 6 in the morning, first responders were dispatched to a fire at Bobby Cross's house. And it's important to mention that a man named Daryl Sims stayed on the couch. This was determined to have been the origin point of the fire.
Mr. Sims, he did have disabilities. He was known to smoke on the couch. Initially, the fire was classified as undetermined, which means that there was no conclusion that the fire was intentionally set.
Well, because the whole situation the night before that I just told you about. Remember now, me and Mr. Cross, we're not arguing. But because of that situation, I guess the family members had animosity. Jackie Cross, his daughter, ended up being one of the main people accusing me of starting the fire.
Thankfully, the investigators followed the facts at the scene, and therefore the deaths were ruled accidental. This did not become a homicide investigation until 3 months later. A man named Gary Jennings, the boyfriend of one of Bobby Cross's relatives, Shanna Tyler, Gary Jennings is arrested for driving without a license, cannabis possession, and copying audio-video recordings for gain.
Then that last one was a felony charge. He had previously been convicted of the same offense and was on probation at the time. Gary Jennings said to police, and he testified at trial, that the impetus for him making contact with Dwayne was that another individual, Deshaun Seabrooks, told Gary Jennings that Dwayne had made a big mistake. He used different words. But Gary said, "That made me contact Dwayne, and Dwayne confessed to me."
So Gary Jennings claimed that Dwayne said that he lit the blaze after this argument over rent money, which sounds like the kind of narrative that might arise when perhaps an investigator looks into the address to which Dwayne was paroled, but not where he actually lived. By the way, this statement was unrecorded.
It's always a red flag when there is a so-called statement or confession that's not recorded. Prime opportunity to just make something up. And the fact that Mr. Jennings was currently in jail facing some pretty serious charges while he was already on probation, and he just magically has all of this information about a quote-unquote crime that had occurred and that Mr. Williams was involved, all of those things also very problematic.
And then from what we understand as well, I believe his felony charge is dismissed.
Yeah, he got a really sweet deal out of this.
Gary Jennings, he's not a snitch, he's a liar, because I never talked to him about anything. It was never anything for him to talk about. Mm-hmm. But after Gary Jennings popped up and talks to corrupt police officers and comes up with a rent story, then months later, the family members come up with a rent story and a motive too. So in the beginning, this didn't exist.
Despite no previous mention of this rent disagreement from the Cross family, their statements and eventual testimony become aligned with Gary Jennings' statement.
I think the statement itself is suspect, but what came after, or what didn't come after, is arguably even more concerning, because a member of the public can go to the police and say whatever they want to, but it's on the police and other law enforcement, prosecutors and the like, to make sure that the statement is credible if they intend to use it. And in fact, police talk with people, specifically of Deshaun Seabrooks, who discredited Mr. Jennings' statement. And unfortunately, that statement was never disclosed to Duane or to his attorney. So everything that police had weighed in favor of discrediting Mr. Jennings, but instead they decided to credit him and cover up evidence that he was incredible and proceed with trial.
But first, they had to present the dubious statement to the medical examiner to have her reconsider the cause of these two deaths.
The deaths were initially deemed accidents. The medical examiner changed the determination to homicide. But we actually went back and spoke with the medical examiner, who told us that if she were evaluating the case now, the correct determination, if there was going to be one, for manner of death should have been undetermined.
But that determination was the last stopgap between Duane and charges for arson and two counts of felony murder.
I was at my sister-in-law's house, and I'm in the basement asleep. All of a sudden, I heard somebody calling my name, and they ended up coming down. They had guns out. They cuffed me. And I remember I kept asking, like, what are you arresting me for? And they never told me what was going on. But they brought me outside, took me to the station. And I remember getting there, and we got in the room. They started talking about the fire. I guess I was kind of shocked. And a lot of the things he's saying to me, it doesn't make sense. You know, you watch TV shows and the police say, well, we already know the answers to the questions. He asked me questions like, had me and Mr. Cross ever had disputes about money? No, I never got any money from him. He never got any money from me. But I didn't realize that he was asking this question because of the lies that Jenny told.
For some reason, the prosecution had trouble locating Gary Jennings for trial as scheduled. So it was postponed until August 28, 2013, when he testified about Deshaun Seabrooks telling him about Duane, who then allegedly confessed to setting the house on fire over a disagreement about rent, as well as how Gary Jennings' girlfriend Shanna Tyler had told him about the fire, but only after this alleged confession. Strangely, neither Tyler nor Seabrooks participated, but Bobby Cross's daughter, Jackie, did.
Then Miss Cross gets on the stand, and now she has a story about 2 weeks worth of arguments over rent, which is what Jenny said, and made it look like me and her father were having continuous problems. And none of those things that she testified to ever happened. And my lawyer didn't do any investigation, wouldn't talk to anybody.
And had he spoken to Deshaun Seabrooks or Miss Tyler, perhaps he would have been able to impeach the state's witnesses. But most importantly, the defense neglected to even consult with a fire expert.
One thing that stood out to me immediately was that only one expert testified, and that expert was the government's expert. Captain McNulty, who's now retired, who arrived at the scene hours after the fire, testified on behalf of the prosecution. But no defense expert testified to poke holes in what turned out to be a really faulty analysis.
McNulty testified that no smoking materials were found near the couch, but oddly, no photographic evidence was shared with the defense nor offered to the jury to corroborate that claim. McNulty also claimed that an open flame, like a cigarette lighter, was a more likely cause of the blaze, and that it's extremely hard to get a couch to burn with a cigarette. This all begs the question, are all couches the same? Are all materials as flammable as others? Additionally, nothing was offered to rule out a smoldering cigarette or any other possible accidental cause.
I would say in most arson cases, the defense should at least consult an expert. But here, we have two sets of problems, and you've pointed out some of them. We have problems with the expert's testimony, even knowing what the defense and the prosecution knew at the time of trial, what was presented and unchallenged. And then we have things that we discovered in our investigation later on that blew this wide open.
And we'll get to all that they hid from the defense in just a bit. But still, trial counsel failed to use what was available to him to discredit the state's case. Not only lay witnesses, but also their expert. Even the jury was curious enough to ask for the transcript of McNulty's testimony and other documents, as they were deadlocked for some time. But ultimately, Duane was convicted on one count of arson, one count second-degree murder, and one count felony murder, resulting in a life sentence without the possibility of parole.
At that moment, Cross family members were making faces at me. Like little kids, like you stick your tongue out like that.
What?
They kept doing stuff like that to me. And really bothered me about that word that you just sat in this courtroom and got my whole life took from me. And now you back there doing that. You think this is a game.
The American West with Dan Flores is the latest show from the Meat Eater Podcast Network, hosted by me, writer and historian Dan Flores, and brought to you by Velvet Buck. This podcast looks at a West available nowhere else. Each episode, I'll be diving into some of the lesser-known histories of the West. I'll then be joined in conversation by guests such as Western historian Dr. Randall Williams and best-selling author and Meat Eater founder Stephen Ranella.
I'll correct my kids now and then where they'll say when cave people were here. And I'll say, it seems like the Ice Age people that were here didn't have a real affinity for caves.
So join me starting Tuesday, May 6th, where we'll delve into stories of the West and come to understand how it helps inform the ways in which we experience the region today.
Listen to The American West with Dan Flores on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I know a lot of cops, and they get asked all the time, have you ever had to shoot your gun? Sometimes the answer is yes, but there's a company dedicated to a future where the answer will always be no.
Across the country, cops call this taser the revolution.
But not everyone was convinced it was that simple.
Cops believed everything that taser told them.
From Lava for Good and the team that brought you Bone Valley comes a story about what happened when a multi-billion-dollar company dedicated itself to one visionary mission. This is Absolute Season 1, Taser Incorporated.
I get right back there and it's bad. It's really, really, really bad.
Listen to new episodes of Absolute Season 1, Taser Incorporated, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Binge episodes 1, 2, and 3 on May 21st, and episodes 4, 5, and 6 on June 4th, ad-free at Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
The Medal of Honor is the highest military decoration in the United States. Recipients have done the improbable, showing immense bravery and sacrifice in the name of something much bigger than themselves.
This medal is for the men who went down that day. It's for the families of those who didn't make it.
I'm J.R. Martinez. I'm a U.S. Army veteran myself, and I'm honored to tell you the stories of these heroes on the new season of Medal of Honor: Stories of Courage from Pushkin Industries and iHeart Podcast. From Robert Blake, the first Black sailor to be awarded the medal, to Daniel Daly, one of only 19 people to have received the Medal of Honor twice. These are stories about people who have distinguished themselves by acts of valor, going above and beyond the call of duty. You'll hear about what they did, what it meant, and what their stories tell us about the nature of courage and sacrifice. Listen to Medal of Honor on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I think that until you're in a real serious situation, maybe people think the appeal process works. There's all these mechanisms in the system that look like they work until you the guy stuck in the system trying to use them. As time goes on and you watch people who you know and they file briefs and you know that they should have won and they got shot down, it's hard to keep hope. So going through the process, I was disappointed. Things were getting shot down and at some point I decided that I can comprehend things, I can read well. I decided I better do my own legal work because at least if I stay in prison, it's my fault I can live with that.
After Duane's direct appeal was denied up through the state Supreme Court as well as on federal habeas, he began writing to anyone who might be able to help, which included the newly formed Wayne County Conviction Integrity Unit. This is how Ann Garrett and the Cooley Innocence Project got involved.
The Cooley Innocence Project has a partnership with the Wayne County Conviction Integrity Unit. Cooley is primarily a DNA and forensic clinic. And in 2020, his case was referred to our office here at Cooley. A very sharp student came across Duane's file and brought it to our attention and said, something is very wrong with this man's conviction. And the student and the staff attorney went to visit Dwayne and introduce themselves.
And then Dwayne's outreach also scored him help with the Michigan Appellate Defender's Office in 2021.
I ended up on the case kind of through dumb luck. Dwayne had filed a request for counsel, and on post-judgment motions like this one, it's very rare at that stage of the proceedings to get counsel appointed, but it happened that way. And it was exciting to me to work on a case with actual innocence issues. And by the time I came on the scene, he had already done so much research, so much writing, so much communication with Cooley. So he had set up the case really nicely. Shortly after we were appointed, we started peppering different law enforcement agencies with requests for records, documents, police reports, photos. And there are two big things that came out of our first and most important FOIA request. One was a version of the fire investigator's report that had not previously been disclosed to the defense. At the time of trial, Dwayne's trial counsel had a version of the fire investigator report that had most all of the information in it, but one very important fact was missing from that report. And when you look at the two side by side, it almost looks as if a piece of the report has been cut out, not exactly like white out, but almost like excised from the version that we ultimately obtained. And that line stated that a Zippo-style lighter was found in the debris near the area of origin, which was near a couch that had been consumed by the fire, but that was where the fire investigator thought the fire had originated.
Which is obviously a Brady violation. It's also interesting that the same fire investigator even eschewed a smoldering cigarette as a less likely option to a lighter, like the one removed from that report.
So we discovered that there was this additional version of the report. We also discovered that there were 58 photos that had never been given to the defense. And in those photos, you could see the Zippo-style lighter that was indeed at the area of origin. So this mattered because the defense theory at trial, and our theory now, is that the fire was caused by careless smoking. It was an accident. There were people in the house who were known to smoke in the house, and one of the people who sadly died was known to smoke on the couch that was the area of origin. When the fire investigator tells the jury that there are no smoking materials at the scene, that really discredits the defense theory. But in fact, there was a smoking material. A lighter is a smoking material. And so that was something that was major and that, as I said before, really blew the case wide open.
For a lot of us listening tonight, the idea of purposely excising something that pivotal feels illegal, if not highly unethical.
It is illegal and unethical. I do not know who did it, and I do not know if it was done purposefully. I have to be totally honest with you. I think we can all imagine what may or may not have happened, but at this point, all I can tell you is that it's in one version and it's not in another. And both of those reports, the what I call the original and then the redacted or excised version, were both in the prosecutor's possession at the time of trial.
This also leads naturally to another question. If there is this Zippo lighter in the photograph, what happened to the physical object?
Well, we know that the prosecution could not locate it during the course of our investigation years after trial, and there's no record of it ever having been collected and kept or tested or anything that should have happened. Our expert, Mark Fennell, talked with us about the importance of, in a case like this, collecting any smoking materials, any implements that could have been used to start a fire, and then testing them to determine whether they actually had the capability of starting the fire. So unfortunately, that was not done. No one has come forward with the lighter, not the Detroit Police Department, not the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office. So to our knowledge, their lighter does not exist and it was never collected and certainly was not tested.
Okay. And Mark Fennell also called into question some of the earlier statements by Captain McNulty, especially the idea of flammability of couches and cigarettes, and something I thought a lot of people would have already clocked. Not all couches are made of the same material. I mean, some stuff is more flammable than other stuff, right?
That's absolutely right. That's something that, unfortunately, the jury did not hear at the original trial. And I wish they had, because Mark Fennell even provided us with a video that to this day lives rent-free in my mind because it shows just how quickly many of the couches that we may have in our homes could combust and could start an absolutely disastrous fire. So it's true that it's difficult to light a leather couch on fire, but the evidence that we have suggests that the couch that was consumed in the fire here was not leather. It was a more polyester type of couch that is more easy to light on fire. So for Captain McNulty to testify that it's incredibly difficult to get a couch to burn with a cigarette, I can't say whether he was intentionally misleading the jury. I hope he wasn't. But in fact, we know that the jury did not get a complete and full picture of what went on in this fire or what could happen in general when you hold a cigarette to a couch or you drop, for example, a cigarette in between couch cushions. That seems like a very likely story here that Mr. Sims, he did have disabilities. He was known to smoke on the couch that was eventually the origin of the fire. It is possible that he fell asleep and dropped a cigarette. So I can tell you that even if it wasn't intentional, Captain McNulty definitely misled the jury into believing that the couch here could not have caught on fire but for an intentionally set fire.
That's the lawyer answer. My answer is yes. And he knew what he was doing and he did it on purpose.
I know a lot of cops, and they get asked all the time, have you ever had to shoot your gun? Sometimes the answer is yes, but there's a company dedicated to a future where the answer will always be no.
Across the country, cops call this taser the revolution.
But not everyone was convinced it was that simple.
Cops believed everything that Taser told them.
From Lava for Good and the team that brought you Bone Valley comes a story about what happened when a multi-billion dollar company dedicated itself to one visionary mission. This is Absolute Season 1, Taser Incorporated.
I get right back there and it's bad. It's really, really, really bad.
Listen to new episodes of Absolute Season 1, Taser Incorporated on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Binge episodes 1, 2, and 3 on May 21st and episodes 4, 5, and 6 on June 4th, ad-free at Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts.
The American West with Dan Flores is the latest show from the Meat Eater Podcast Network, hosted by me, writer and historian Dan Flores, and brought to you by Velvet Buck. This podcast looks at a West available nowhere else. Each episode, I'll be diving into some of the lesser-known histories of the West. I'll then be joined in conversation by guests such as Western historian Dr. Randall Williams and best-selling author and Meat Eater founder Stephen Ranella.
I'll correct my kids now and then where they'll say when cave people were here. And I'll say, it seems like the Ice Age people that were here didn't have a real affinity for caves.
So join me starting Tuesday, May 6th, where we'll delve into stories of the West and come to understand how it helps inform the ways in which we experience the region today.
Listen to The American West with Dan Flores on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Medal of Honor is the highest military decoration in the United States. Recipients have done the improbable, showing immense bravery and sacrifice in the name of something much bigger than themselves.
This medal is for the men who went down that day. It's for the families of those who didn't make it.
I'm J.R. Martinez. I'm a U.S. Army veteran myself, and I'm honored to tell you the stories of these heroes on the new season of Medal of Honor: Stories of Courage from Pushkin Industries and iHeart Podcast. From Robert Blake, the first black sailor to be awarded the medal, to Daniel Daly, one of only 19 people to have received the Medal of Honor twice. These are stories about people who have distinguished themselves by acts of valor, going above and beyond the call of duty. You'll hear about what they did, what it meant, and what their stories tell us about the nature of courage and sacrifice. Listen to Medal of Honor on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It It's difficult to maintain faith in this investigation and these people, especially when we see a Brady violation of this magnitude. I'm, of course, speaking about what appears to be an altered version of the original fire investigation report, and it becomes even more difficult to maintain faith when you consider Deshaun Seabrooks.
Gary Jennings said to police and testified at trial that I got information from Deshaun and that made me contact Dwayne. What the defense was never told at the time of trial, and what we didn't get our hands on until years of working on the case myself, was a statement by Deshaun Seabrooks. The Wayne County prosecutor sent an investigator to speak with Deshaun Seabrooks. Deshaun Seabrooks told the prosecutor's investigator that he did not know Gary Jennings and he did not know about any fire supposedly involving Dwayne until law enforcement told him about that. So not only hadn't they talked about the fire, but that he didn't even know Gary.
But wait, there's more.
Yes, there was another witness who the prosecution interviewed and whose statement was not turned over to the defense, and his name was Ron Rogers. Now, Ron Rogers' involvement in all of this is a little bit more attenuated, but we can sum it up by saying that had Mr. Rogers' statement been turned over to the defense, the defense could have chosen to either call him as a witness or call the prosecution's investigator as a witness to discredit some of the other lay witnesses. For example, Jackie Cross told police that they got some of their information from Ron Rogers. But when Ron Rogers talked to the prosecutor's investigator, Mr. Rogers said that he didn't know anything about the fire. And so, again, it's a bit attenuated, but ultimately, you have people coming to court and testifying to things that they say are corroborated or known by other people. And then when the prosecution goes and talks with those other people, they don't know anything. And unfortunately, the jury never heard that. And the defense didn't even know about those statements or those interviews that the prosecution's investigator did. And we submitted a couple of different documents, applications to the Conviction Integrity Unit, summarizing all the relevant evidence. Then they did additional investigation. We did have Denver Butler, who was an investigator, an independent person who was able to do additional interviews and track down witnesses. So there was a lot of movement from a lot of different parties on this case. But ultimately, the Conviction Integrity Unit reviewed everything and recommended that Dwayne be granted relief. That recommendation then goes to the head prosecutor in Wayne County, Kim Worthy, and she signed off and agreed that yes, the conviction here was wrongful and should not stand.
So now all they needed was a court date to file a joint motion to vacate convictions and sentences, which happens on June 17th, 2024, over a decade after Dwayne's arrest.
To hear the judge say that my sentence was vacated, and to know that it finally went away. After all that time, it was really gone. That was something. Walking out the prison at like 5 o'clock that afternoon, walking through the metal detectors, going out of the prison. And I remember like how some of the COs were talking to me. And I remember thinking, well, man, why didn't they talk to me like that before? But just walking out that gate and getting in those bins and coming to Detroit, knowing that I was coming back to Detroit, I don't know how to describe it, really.
Now that Dwayne's out, he's been working with two nonprofits, one called Firefly Advocates, which works toward criminal legal system reform, as well as supporting reintegration for system-impacted folks. And the second comes to us from another Michigan-based exoneree, Ken Nixon. His group is called the Organization of Exonerees. We'll link those in the episode description. Outside of that, Dwayne is back out there making music, meeting other artists, and we'll link ways for you to find him.
Yeah, you can go to like YouTube, Diablo, D-I-A-B-L-O-Y-N-S. And I just posted on my Facebook for the first time since I've been out, I started recording. So it's like a little snippet or something.
Resurrected in the cell, I was property of the saints and through a trial for the lies, full of greed. Hit the yard, I was mobbing, even caught me with a knife. I'm up to police and your rules, I got 30 with natural light. Huh? I'm innocent, I'm indigent, plus I could read. Plus hit the law library, read case after case. Told them legal heads, they the fuck out my face. Get I'm respect on the yard, cause I'm fighting it straight. The homies right. See me getting close, I'm getting closer and closer. Zoom meets attorney meetings, man, this shit gonna be over. Touchdown with bitches, you ain't seen me around. Huh? Guess I'm easy to miss, flying in and out of town. I'm like, sick, who got a problem, probably holler at me. Still Hollywood, so I'm good in every hood in the deep. No. Rapper numbers, what I'm doing, but I ain't calling them out. Hit the bank a couple times, put a couple hundred out for sure.
kind of interested when I'm talking about the wrongful conviction. So I just did that this morning.
We wish Dwayne all the luck in the world. And with that, we come to the last segment of the show, where first, I'd like to thank you all for joining us today. Then I'll open the space for our guests to share any closing thoughts they might have. Why don't we go in alphabetical order? So we'll start with Anne, then Maya, and last but not least, we leave it to Dwayne.
Dwayne's case is a case that never should have happened. A crime wasn't committed. I think that society has this false sense that it's a justice system. Look at all the people that were impacted by Dwayne's case, including Dwayne, his family, society. And it takes an absurd amount of time. I always tell people it's like unringing a bell. It's very easy, in theory, to put someone into this situation, but it takes a miracle to get someone out of this situation. Without the State Appellate Defender Office and with our collaboration with the Wayne County Conviction Integrity Unit and having conviction integrity units and the determination and the persistence of the director, Val Newman, I'm not sure that we would be having this discussion right now. And Dwayne's story, sadly, is not unique. If people knew that this was happening in their own communities and how it impacts everybody from a emotional standpoint, from a financial standpoint. That's the big thing that I push all the time is the education of wrongful convictions.
I would also note that at the time of Dwayne's trial, he was represented by appointed counsel. And I happen to know the attorney who represented him, and he does a lot of really great work. So this is not to slander him or to suggest that he's a bad lawyer, but I will say that the system, particularly at the time Dwayne was facing trial in 2012 and 2013, the provision of counsel to indigent people, people who are facing charges as serious as the ones Dwayne was facing, was not good at all. And there have been lots of improvements in Michigan since then, but I do know that in other states, there are similar problems that still occur where people are not provided a lawyer who has the capacity and time to assist them properly, who has the funding requisite to hire an investigator or an expert, both of which, in my view, should have been done in this case. So I would just point out that there are systemic issues that led to some of the problems here. And as I mentioned, we were appointed by really a fluke. And so the fact that Dwayne got counsel on appeal or on a secondary appeal was also pretty unusual and is still unusual today. So I would just say that I do think there are lots and lots of people who are inside prison serving time, sometimes life sentences for crimes they did not commit, but they don't have lawyers to assist them.
This really did take a team. And that's one of the things that guys in prison said to me before I left. I don't have what you had, but God put all of these things in place and all of these people in place to help me. And I really realize now how hard it is and how blessed I really am. So I'm going to use the words of Ken Nixon, the president of the Organization of Exonerees. Ken always says, it starts with voting. A prosecutor is a powerful position and they answer to the people. And all your choices when you vote, you need to really be careful and pay attention. It's important. In education, learning this system, I think that they should teach us Ms. Menlo's favorite, the 4th, 5th, 6th Amendment. In school, especially in areas where you might be more likely to have legal problems, because when you don't know anything, anything can happen to you.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
We have worked hard to ensure that all facts reported in this show are accurate. The views and opinions expressed by the individuals featured in this show are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Lava for Good.
What up, y'all? This your main man, Memphis Bleek, right here. Host the Rock Solid Podcast. June is Black Music Month, so what better way to celebrate than listening to my exclusive conversation with my bro, Ja Rule?
The one thing they can't stop you or take away from you is knowledge. So whatever I went through while I was down in prison for 2 years, through that process, learn from it.
Check out this exclusive episode with Ja Rule on Rock Solid. Open your free iHeartRadio app, search Rock Solid, and listen now.
I also want to address the Tonys.
On a recent episode of Checking In with Michelle Williams, I open up about feeling snubbed by the Tony Awards. Do I?
I was never mad. I was disappointed because I had high hopes.
To hear this and more on disappointment and protecting your peace, listen to Checking In with Michelle Williams from the Black Effect Podcast Network on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You say you'd never give in to a meltdown. Never let kids' toys take over the house. And never fill your feed with kid photos. You'd never plan your life around their schedule. Never lick your thumb to clean their face. And you'd never let them leave the house looking like less than their best. You say you'd never put a pacifier in your mouth to clean it. Never let them stay up too late. And never let them run wild through the grocery store.
Clean up on aisle 6 and aisle 3.
So when you say you'd never let them get into a car without you there, no, it can happen. 1 in 4 hot car deaths happen when a kid gets into an unlocked car and can't get out. Never happens. Before you leave the car, always stop, look, lock. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.